I will say that Bill and Andy are not wearing ties today, so I'm looks like I copied you, Jim. Sorry.
It's hard to wear a tie around the house.
I'm trying to copy Bill if I can.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we are recording and broadcasting. Chair McGrath, the floor is yours.
Good morning. I have to pull up my script here. Good morning. Welcome to the virtual meeting of the California Regional Water Quality Control Board, San Francisco Bay Region. I'm Jim McGrath. I'm chair of the San Francisco Bay Water Board, and we will call the roll for other board members in just 1 minute. But first, I want to note that today's board meeting is conducted in accordance with the COVID-19 emergency order to comply with the public gathering limitations as authorized by Government Code Section 1133. There's no physical meeting room. This may be the last of those, and you'll hear from Tom about that. For people who only want to listen or watch the meeting, the board's customary webcast is available. In addition, we are receiving public comments through a Zoom meeting platform. If you intend to comment or think you might be interested in commenting, you should already be in the Zoom meeting room. The Zoom meeting room is a little bit funny because we're all in our home rooms of some sort. If you've not already received a link, you can visit our website and sign up. Julie, please share the website address. Oh, she is on it. For all speakers, we ask that you state your name when called upon. We appreciate your patience and understanding during this extraordinary time. I'd like to recognize at this point, Julie Haas, our new executive assistant, and ask her to call the roll. Julie.
Hello, everybody, and welcome for me to my first meeting. Roll call, Board Member Young.
Here.
Board Member Gunther.
Here.
Board Member Hacker.
Here, and welcome.
Thank you. Board Member Giffinger.
Here, and welcome also.
Board Member, Vice Chair Batty.
Here, welcome aboard.
Thank you. And Chair McGrath.
I'm here and I'm going to make it unanimous. We're really happy to have you.
Thank you.
You're working in a great outfit.
Thank you, appreciate.
Tom Mumley, our interim executive officer, has informed me that we have some new staff members to introduce. Take it away, Tom.
Yes, thanks. And of course, the cat's out of the bag. One of the first new staff person I plan to introduce is our new executive assistant, Julie Haas. And I told Julie I was going to kind of give a quick bio of her. But Julie, I think, you know, you get spunk. I'm just going to ask you just to quickly tell the board a couple points about yourself that I would, rather than me paraphrasing what you told me. But I just got to say, we are very, very excited about Julie. She's got excellent credentials, lots of enthusiasm, and, you know, most importantly, she really identified an interest in wanting to be part of our team. And so, Julie, you want to just tell the board a couple things about yourself?
Yes, absolutely. Hello, board members. I have been in the private sector for most of my career, and healthcare technology has been my passion, where I chose to make a difference. And looked for my next step after I finished a five-year stint in consulting and wanted to belong to a really unique team doing great things in our community, and found the SF board. So I'm really excited. I'm a water baby. I grew up on the beach in Southern California, and I live in Pacifica on the beach in Northern California, and I'm super excited to be here. So thank you all for welcoming me and your patience as I figure all this out.
Hey, Julie, can you turn your camera on for a second so we can say hi?
Can you see?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hello, everyone.
Nice to meet you, Julie.
Good to see you.
Julie did mention that a fact that she told me that she actually earned a gold medal at the senior games in women's water polo. So, so she's a super water. She's a super water person.
I said I'm a water baby.
Boy, I know what that takes cardiovascularly. That's impressive.
I'm tough. Thank you. And I like chocolate, if anyone's wondering. So, thank you.
So obviously, Julie gets, you know, demonstrates that, yeah, she's going to fit in quite well from quickly. Thank you, Julie. So moving on, I'm going to call on Ron Gullibo, who's going to introduce a new, Michelle Thompson.
Good morning, board members. My name is Ron Gullibo, as Tom says. I'm the senior engineering geologist that's the supervisor for the new section, Section 4. And I am pleased to introduce Michelle Thompson, who joins us in the Toxic Cleanup Division as an environmental scientist. Michelle's first day in the office was February 14th, so she's been here almost a month. Michelle is a Bay Area product. Her education is quite diverse. She's got a bachelor's degree in marine biology from UCLA, a master's degree in environmental policy from Columbia, and then she's got a PhD in environmental science and engineering, again, back from UCLA. Prior to joining the Water Board, Michelle spent 3 years as a regulatory analyst at the California Public Utility Commission. And you know, my first impression, is Michelle's a fast learner and she's making strides to understand the investigation and remediation work that we do in the Toxic Cleanup Division. She is part of the taking a role in our inactive case assessment focused on the environmental justice areas in the Bay Area. So I'm going to turn it over to Michelle to describe her PhD program. It's kind of an interesting non-traditional program and her take on her first month here at the Water Board. And then maybe she could tell us what she does outside of work for fun. So Michelle, what do you say?
Thanks, Ron. Good morning, everyone. Thanks for the warm welcome. I wanted to just give you an overview of the program that really helped shape me to get to where I'm at today. UCLA, go Bruins, if there's any Bruins here. It's a Doctor of Environment. So instead of a PhD, it's a DENV, but it's a doctorate nonetheless. And I found it very amazing because of the interdisciplinary facet of it. Instead of being molded into become a professor, you could still become one. I actually was focusing on learning as much as I could from different departments in order to be an environmental expert or advisor. So most of the people who take the program go off to have, they go off to have programs. To have jobs at agencies in the government or locally. And the program was founded by a Nobel laureate, Willard Libby, in 1973. Some of the courses I took were from a variety of academic departments, including engineering, business management, public policy, and school of law. So I took water law there. And after 2 years of coursework, I defended my qualifying exam and prospectus and was able to choose a location, a job where I would write my dissertation at. So instead of staying at UCLA, I chose to move all the way southeast to Singapore. And the reason for that was because my passion was focusing on solar desalination and water purification technologies. And Singapore is a leader of both desal and solar. So while I was there, I wrote my dissertation on the different feasibility of off-grid water purification technologies for Southeast Asia. And to segue to my first month at the Water Board, it's been a great welcoming experience for me. I felt very supported and I've been able to meet as many people, not only my colleagues, but also Ron has helped me set up meetings to understand the different parts of the organization by meeting with senior management. I've also been able to take different onboarding courses ranging from vapor intrusion to environmental screening levels. And when I'm not working on cases, what I like to do for fun, I've been really interested in learning about architecture and mid-century modern furniture is something that I really like. So thanks again for welcoming me, and I'm really excited to get a chance to meet and work with you all. Thank you.
Welcome, Michelle.
Thank you, Michelle. I mean, I would love to tell you about all the great museums in the Bay Area that you can learn about these things, but The LA museums are not too bad either. So you've probably seen a bit. Huh. All right, welcome aboard. Tom, next.
Oh, yes, excuse me. Yeah, John Wolfenden, I have...
Hello, board members. My name is John Wolfenden. Like Ron, I'm a section leader in the Toxics Cleanup Division. And like Ron, we're both returning here after, on the heels of both of us introducing two new staff last month, we're back to say, but wait, there's more. And so it's my pleasure to introduce Ellen Mills. Ellen, if you haven't already, could you turn on your camera? Ellen is the newest water resource control engineer in the Toxics Cleanup Division. We're always happy when we can promote people from within. And this is Ellen's third job here at the Water Board. She was previously a Watersheds Steward Program member. And then most recently, before this promotion, she was a scientific aide in the Toxics Cleanup Division. So Ellen, could you say hello and tell the board members a bit more about yourself?
Hello. Hi. I have a Bachelor of Science in Earth Science from UC Santa Cruz and a Master of Science in Environmental Engineering from UC Berkeley. Before starting at the Water Board as a Watershed Stewards Program member, I worked as a geotechnical laboratory technician and supervisor for a geotechnical consulting firm for about 2 years. Outside of work, I enjoy hiking, dancing, surfing, and painting, and I'm happy to be here supporting the Water Board's mission.
Welcome aboard, Ellen. Where do you surf?
Sometimes I go to Santa Cruz, and I like to go surfing there, and also down in Morro Bay, in the San Francisco area.
Good. I am a firm believer that being in the water gives you a spiritual orientation towards protecting its water quality. I think you think the same thing.
Yeah.
You can't swim in it or float on it and not want to protect it. Good on you. All right. And there's one more.
I just want to make note. Thank you, Ellen. But Ellen's just another example of how fortunate we've been to have the Watershed Stewards Program, where we've had a chance to engage with really sharp young people who then have, some of which, like Ellen, become staff members. And others actually have showed up at other boards, as well as our scientific aid program. It's a great way to, it's a win-win for people to get some experience, and often that experience leads to opportunities with us. So we're really happy about how that works out. But lastly, Lori Tall will introduce Nicole Farley, who's not a new person, but she's coming into a new position in the office. So Lori, can you introduce?
Yes. Good morning, board members. I'm Lori Tall. I'm a senior environmental scientist in the planning division and the lead of our agricultural lands program section. I'd like to introduce you to our newest member, Nicole Farley. She's worked at our board for about the past 5 years, working in our watershed division as a water resources control engineer. She was also a watershed stewards program member here at the board. And during her 5 years in the watershed division, she prepares water quality certs related to dredge and fill streams and wetlands. And during this time, she's developed an expertise in an engineered stream restoration and enhancement. And she's done permitting and design of many fish habitat projects in our region. She has an ecological engineering degree from Oregon State, and she's currently working on her master's in fishery biology. So her education and experience fills a large gap for us in the planning division after two recent retirements. And she will serve for us. She'll be our creek restoration design expert, providing engineering review and permitting of large and small projects. And she'll also be coordinating our non-point source grant program and supporting our other agricultural regulatory programs as well. She brings a lot of enthusiasm and passion for protecting fisheries and using up-to-date engineering techniques. And we're really excited to have her join our group. And I'll let Nicole say something a little bit about herself and what she likes to do.
Yeah. Hi, everyone. Many of you probably know me, but Yeah, I'm really excited to be making this transition, though it's bittersweet to be moving on from all the great work happening in Watershed. I grew up in San Jose, and I've been working at the Water Board for 5 years and have collaborated and been mentored by a lot of the staff in Lori's division over the years. So I'm super excited to be kind of joining this team and working on these projects that I've helped with permitting before, but kind of on a different level from a different side of things. So I'm really excited. Professionally, my interests are, you know, stream restoration, ecosystem recovery. Outside of the office, I really enjoy painting and yoga, and I finally just got a bicycle, so I'm looking forward to getting used to that mode of transport next.
Thank you, Nicole. Welcome aboard. All right. That brings us to public forum. I understand we have some comments from the long-standing Marinwood Plaza. Before we call on them, I'd just like to remind everybody first that there is an update in the executive officer's report. So you should take a look at that. And second, because there is some possibility of enforcement action at some level, and due process is absolutely vital in fairness on those. Please don't comment on aspects that may in any event end up in that forum. So Julie, go ahead and tell me who the group is and promote the first one.
I believe Wes is doing their promotion.
Okay. Sorry, Wes, go ahead.
I promoted Bill.
Morning, Bill. Are you unmuted? Can you go ahead?
There we go. All right. I'm here. No picture popping up. That's all right. Many of you know me, Bill McNicholas, with the Clean Up Marinwood Plaza Now Oversight Committee. Been doing this committee for 10 years, since 2012. And we still have a contaminated plaza sitting down there. We do have a market, which is good, but I'd like to see this thing eventually get cleaned up. And it just seems like the discharger keeps delaying. And I know you're going to be talking about enforcement later, so I won't go into all that. But I know there's been no enforcement on it, of their missing deadlines and everything else for the past 10 years. One concern to me, which I missed last meeting because of a doctor's appointment, is documents disappearing off of GeoTracker. In fact, Cleet Carlton had an email out back a couple months ago, which he cited these documents for enforcement, which would be the enforcement standards for Hoyt to move forward on cleaning up the plaza. When I got that email, I went online. Those documents were either moved, edited, or deleted. And I got emails out to Alec and Cleet, and came back, and all of a sudden they reappeared. And don't know why they were in it, were they edited, or what the reasons were, no explanations, but it does concern me that documents up there do disappear. My big concern right now is hopefully Cleet's email he put out recently saying this is going to happen, this will move, will happen. This is just people living in a toxic waste site. We want to get this place developed and start building the area up. But as you know, the state mandated housing, they want to put 183 apartments on that property, low income. And it's not going to happen anyhow until it gets cleaned up, which is at least another 5 or 6 more years. And that's got to be through active decontamination, not just through letting nature take its course. We're concerned about that. That's a different problem. Doesn't concern the water board, but we want it cleaned up and get it developed because it's really an eyesore on the community. And as all, most of you know, we've been here, what, 40, 50 times over the last 10 years. So we're like good old buddies. Anyhow, that's me. I think Steve Nestle's up next, or he's going to speak it.
All right, Wes, if you could look for Steve. I did see Jackie Zipkin's hand raised.
Yeah, Stephen has been promoted, and then I'll get to Jackie next.
Okay. Go ahead, Stephen. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. This is Stephen Nessel with Save Marinwood Plaza Now Committee. We chose that name, I think, 8 years ago. And I don't know what the definition of success is, whether you achieve your goal or you just stick with it. But I want you to know we are going to stick with this till the bitter end. And I am so frustrated that we have to come back time and time again to get action, not paperwork done in the board, but action, get this toxic waste removed. We've got the hot spot. We know where it is. It needs to come out of the ground. We need to remediate. Hoyt has been given every opportunity to skip the rules that have been put in place by your board. And, you know, I don't know, guys, I do believe in you. I do believe in the board. I believe in my community. And I'm actually kind of sympathetic to the Hoyts who have this property because they weren't the ones that created the problem, but they are the responsible party for the cleanup, and they will profit from that property once it is cleaned up. But the community is suffering, our clean water is suffering, and, you know, frankly, the credibility of the board is suffering. Let's just get this done. The time for excuses has expired. That's really, you probably knew what I was going to say before I said it, but I'm going to continue to say it until we get action on this. I suspect if we were so inclined, we could at this point launch a lawsuit. I don't want to do that. I don't think Bill wants to do that. I don't really like lawsuits. I don't like that whole process. And I just want a clean environment, and I want our community to be safe. So thank you very much for listening to me once again.
Stephen, thank you for your stubbornness and your determination. We appreciate it. And I am sorry about the frustration, such as some parts of life. But again, we do appreciate you being here. Wes, I believe Jackie Zipkin is next.
Yep. She's promoted. She's been promoted.
Go ahead, Jackie.
Good morning. Can you hear me okay?
Okay. Good morning. We can indeed.
Excellent. I'm going to change gears on you a little bit. Good morning, Chair McGrath, members of the board. My name is Jackie Zipkin, and I'm the general manager of the East Bay Dischargers Authority, or EBDA. And on behalf of EBDA, along with
the I don't know how to.
Everything good? Okay. On behalf of EBDA, as well as the Bay Area Clean Water Agencies, or BACWA, I am pleased to announce the creation of the Bruce Wolf Memorial Scholarship. EBDA's commission and BACWA's executive board wanted to find a way to honor Bruce's legacy and the positive impact he had on our community and the health of the Bay. And we reached out to Bruce's family, who highlighted that he used to provide STEM-related gifts to his daughters each year. So building on that passion of bringing women and other underrepresented populations into engineering and other clean water fields, we worked with the CASA Education Foundation to create a scholarship that's specifically targeted at Bay Area students who are non-male and identify as Black, Indigenous, or people of color, BIPOC. EBDA and BACWA have pledged to fund the scholarship at $5,000 per year for the next 5 years. And applications are available now at the CASA Education Foundation website. I'll provide a link for staff to share, and they're due by May 15th. So we hope you will join us in publicizing the availability of this scholarship, and we look forward to returning to introduce you to the first Bruce Wolf Scholarship recipient. Thank you.
Thank you. That's wonderful.
That is just lovely. Thank you.
It's totally awesome. I would appreciate if you would also email us if there's an opportunity to sweeten the pot, so to speak. This is something near and dear to my heart, and I'd be happy to throw a chip in. So
let us. Yeah, please do. I agree. I second that.
Well, that was a really nice end to the public forum, and unexpected, and a nice honor for Bruce, and a nice opportunity for people who need opportunities. So that brings us to the minutes. You've been provided with a copy of the minutes. The staff has no recommended changes. I'd like a motion first to approve them, and then let's see if there's any changes. So if I can first get a motion to approve the minutes.
So moved.
Moved by Board Member Gunther. Are there any corrections or changes? Let's get a second.
I'll second.
Second by Member Kissinger. With that, I think we can do this with a raise of hands. All in favor of adopting the minutes, raise your hand, say aye. Aye. Any objections? So ordered unanimously. That brings us to the chair's reports. We'll try to go through this pretty quickly. Andy, do you have any reports?
I just want to call attention to the last month's executive officer's report, which I reread, in particularly with the focus on the survey that the staff conducted of municipal plants and their plans relative to climate change. And I just wanted to say that given the times we're living in, with a pandemic and with tanks rolling in Europe and everything, it's really, really impressive to me. I want to take my hat off to the staff for continuing to have the energy and focus to think about this obvious long-term problem that we're going to face. And it was really very heartening to find out that so many of our permittees are already thinking about the problem and engaged in it. And this kind of thinking played out over the long term is going to be extraordinarily valuable for our community. There's still many communities in the United States that are struggling with outright denialism. And I think that for the Bay Area, we are incredibly well served by the commitment of both the Waterport staff and our permittees to recognizing the reality of the problem that's facing us and planning for it. So I just wanted to take my hat off again to everyone involved in that.
Thank you, Andy. Board Member Hacker.
I wanted to return to something from more than a year ago. We all remember when the vessel, the American Challenger, had run aground off the Marine Sanctuary, Marin County waters, and how difficult it was to begin to address that. And I was very happy to learn from a former colleague that the Coast Guard Commandant and State of California OSPR and EPA have secured the wherewithal to move that vessel when the time is right and to do it safely. But in the interim, the EPA took the lead and did some very high-resolution drone imagery of a section of the Marin coast where the vessel is on the rocks. and organized what is going to be a quite a significant marine debris cleanup in the coastal littoral there. So I think all good. I don't think we're going to get very far away from the problem of abandoned vessels. And there's more happening in the Delta than we have time for today. But I'm just really happy to see progress on that.
Thank you, Board Member Hacker. Board Member Kissinger.
Nothing from me. Thank you.
Thank you. Board Member Young.
Nothing from me, sir.
Thank you, sir. Board Member Batty.
I'm going to be brief today. I have just two quick things. I have been doing some work on the peninsula, San Mateo and Santa Clara County, related to climate and actually equity as well. But I'll pick up on Andy's comment and just say that there's so much good work happening. It's really inspiring to see. But I will say people are still, and organizations are still sort of overwhelmed by the scale of the problem and the issues. And, you know, will what I do make a difference? And so my message is consistently, yes, as Andy says, everyone can and must do something. And so I think if we can continue that, you know, that message that we are sort of all in this together and everyone can and must do something. So I hope we'll keep that up and keep inspiring and encouraging people. And I'll just tie that to one last comment, which is just listening to the introductions of staff today is very inspiring to hear the education and the background and the dedication to this work. And, you know, hats off to the Water Board, hats off to the individuals, and thank you, we need you. Working in this arena. So it's very inspiring. Good things to hear this morning.
Thank you, Board Member Batty, and hear, hear on the talents and dedication of our new staff and our existing staff. I'll be very quick. The only thing I have to report is an upcoming meeting of all the chairs of the Regional Water Quality Control Board, actually going to happen in person on May 20th. So three things to report about that. First, I think there's a strong appeal to have the vice chairs attend either physically or virtually. There was enough support for that I think it's likely. Second, two of the topics that were suggested that I thought might be of interest. First was the idea of what are our educational messages for what we can do and what can and should be done about water supply in response to the drought. The debate tends to be very simplistic. We need to build more reservoirs without much of an understanding of the vast number of reservoirs in California and the unfortunate fact that most of the new reservoirs would end up evaporating almost as much water as they would actually add to the supply. So what's happening in groundwater storage? There are some exciting things. So I'd like, and how does that interrelate with the Groundwater Act Sigma? So that's one topic. The other topic, and again, I think this is a really good topic, not so much for our region, but for the state, is how water management and forest management interrelate. The forests are in many cases far overgrown from what they were before Europeans decided to preserve the landscape as it was. There are, in effect, too many straws into the system, and it does not optimize either water supply or habitat. So those to me are pretty exciting subjects if we can make this interdisciplinary. So I want to let you know about that. And that's the only thing that I have to read. So next, I'm going to call on Laurel Firestone, and I'm going to beg her not to go after the new staff members that have expertise in safe drinking water for communities that are not off on the grid. You leave her alone, Laurel. So welcome.
Thank you all. So I'm excited to be here. My colleague, Board Member McGuire, couldn't be here, so I get to join you all today. A few updates from the State Water Board. First is March is Water Data Month. So we are hosting a 2022 College of Water Informatics workshop series, just each day highlighting different visualization and other tools, web tools, related to water efficiency, drought funding, equity and impacted communities related to water. So you can find more information on our website or through our Twitter pages. But a couple just to highlight, we have a new water use objective exploration tool. So that shows how the forthcoming efficiency standards may affect urban water use. So legislation was passed in 2018 that directed the State Water Board to adopt long-term standards for efficient use of water. And this helps look at each individual water system and how the objectives and efficiency standards may affect that use. We also have information on funding urgent drinking water needs and a mapping tool with that showing active and completed projects. We have a link to DWR's new California Water Watch, which shows current statewide hydroclimate and water supply conditions. And we have a link to a private household water supply where folks can highlight where there's dry wells and water supply shortages for individual wells. So there's a reporting tool that is linked there as well. Another topic that we're focusing on next week is Sacramento River temperature management considerations. So we'll have a board workshop on Wednesday to discuss the current status of the Sacramento River salmon species and Sacramento River temperature management considerations. There'll be panels on hydrologic conditions, including operations, forecasting, and accounting. The status of Sacramento River Chinook salmon, including factors affecting mortality and significance to the population. Assessment of temperature and temperature-dependent modeling and results, and policy considerations, including tribal issues, environmental justice, trade-offs, and other considerations. Also, on Tuesday at our board meeting, we'll be considering an amendment to the intended use plan, which provides the guidelines for it's about $1.5 billion that was allocated in the last budget cycle through the state. We'll also be this summer considering additional adopting a new intended use plan for the new federal funding that will be coming. Let's see, we have a couple program updates. The near and dear to my heart, Safer Drinking Water Program, we held our first advisory group meeting of 2022 that focused specifically on the drinking water needs assessment, which we're revising each year. This year, it included a cost estimate for drought-related resiliency measures, and also expanded analysis to larger systems than it had in the past. It also includes a community outreach and engagement strategy that was discussed with the group. We also have a workshop coming up on the sanitary sewer systems waste discharge requirements general order, which we are in the process of reissuing. So this general order requires public agencies to report sewer spills, develop a sewer system management plan, conduct internal sewer program audits, and really is enforced by the regional boards with assistance from the Office of Enforcement at the State Board. We hosted workshops on this in February, and we'll have staff workshops in February. We're hosting a board workshop to receive public comments at this March 15th coming up. And the public comment period ends on April 8th. Another topic that is near and dear to my heart is the
water and wastewater arrearages payment program. So we, in January, adopted amendments to establish guidelines for wastewater arrearages payments. And that means that wastewater treatment providers that accrued residential or commercial customer debt arrearages during the COVID-19 pandemic period, so between March 4th, 2020 and June 15th, 2021, can apply for funding. Our funding covers those arrearages plus administrative costs. And we have been working closely with the regional boards on this program and really appreciate the assistance and collaboration to try and reach as many wastewater treatment providers to apply for the program as possible. The deadline to apply is April 1st for wastewater. And at our next meeting, the drinking water portion of that already closed, and we'll have an update on that at our next board meeting on the 15th if folks are interested. And let's see, last topic is just we staff hosted a CEQA public scoping meeting for the proposed water quality control policy, which will support the development of site-specific water quality objectives for copper and zinc in freshwater bodies of California using the biotic ligand model. And public comment period ended already March 7th. I think with that, those are the things I wanted to highlight, but happy to answer questions or circle back on with staff on any issues you want to bring to the State Board.
Thank you, State Board Member Firestone. That was a very comprehensive report. Are there any questions for Laura? I don't see any raised hands. I'm trying to juggle the different screens involved in this. Laurel, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Now we'll move on to the executive officer report. Tom, take it from here.
Sure. Thanks, Dick. Yeah, I will say, following up on Laurel's points, we are actively involved in key statewide projects, like such as the statewide order for sanitary sewer collection system stuff. And we've been doing what we can to help with the wastewater arrearages stuff. So we do the best we can to engage on these statewide efforts, as I think you're aware of. So as far as the executive officer report, in addition to noting that we provided an update on the status of the Marineland Plaza cleanup, I'd like to call attention to a key item where we're reporting on our efforts to address climate and climate actions related to groundwater rise impacts. So just to remind you that we've already started enhancing our attention to contaminated sites that particularly may affect environmental justice communities. But now we are enhancing that as well by engaging and communicating with community groups and other agencies where there may be subsurface contamination that could be threatened by potential rising groundwater table associated with sea level rise and potentially other climate change impacts. And so that's becoming a sort of a frontline effort on our part. And to that extent, we are engaged in some studies that are gonna fill data gaps and our understanding of potential for groundwater rise associated with sea level rise around the various bay margins. And then as part of that, we will do some enhanced mapping of contaminated sites and relative threat to rising groundwater and other impacts. So this is sort of the state of the science in play in terms of this territory that we're actively involved in. As you already know, we have also been on a case-by-case basis as we review and update bay margin landfill waste discharge requirements, such as the one that's pending on this agenda item for West Contra Costa County landfill. We include in those orders now a requirement to do flood and sea and resilience or assessments regarding potential for sea level rise impacts, vulnerability assessments. So rather than continue to do it on a case-by-case basis, we actually are in the, we have drafted and will be soon be public noticing a general order, which will essentially amend all the remaining Bay Margin landfills to include this, these requirements to do such assessments. And I tentatively, that might be before you in June. And then we are now beginning the consideration of what we should be asking cleanup sites in these vulnerable areas to do as well to make sure that we're adequately accounting for the future and as we determine appropriate cleanup and remediation strategies. So that's actually, I consider very exciting new work that we're working on, enhancing what we'd already been pretty much on top of, but making sure we're not missing anything there. So that's and we'll keep reporting to you on these climate change related issues on a regular basis. And I'll, in addition to what's in the report, I want to, I'll entertain any questions if you have on the report. I also want to, as referred by Chair McGrath at the beginning of the meeting, I'll take questions first, and then before I raise the next issue, which is above and beyond what's in the executive officer's report. So I see Andy, Board Member Gunther.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. This is a really important issue, this groundwater issue. I'm really, really glad that we're out in front of it. It's actually way more complicated than I realized. I just had the opportunity at BCDC to have a briefing from Christina Hill. And at some point I think it would be great, as our knowledge develops, to figure out a time when we can have an informational item on our agenda to bring us all up to speed on the kind of things we're beginning to understand about how this might play out.
Good suggestion. Excellent. I see that's a logical outgrowth of the work that we're doing, and that we can bring an actual informational item to you and present to you our efforts and efforts by others on the state of the science and actions there. Board Member Hecker.
Question page 8 of your EO report. There was a substantial violation noted, and I wondered about the location of that violation and the opportunity for, anyway, the location of the violation.
In the San Ramon area.
Okay. Thanks.
And Tom, before you go on, I'd like to echo Andy's comment. I've seen quite a bit of Christina's work and tried to think about that here in Berkeley. The process of fill creates aquicludes in some cases and creates channels for transmission in other places. So one of the things that I would like to begin to come out of that into our scientific efforts are what is the level of new research and monitoring we should be doing. This is a very slow moving train wreck, but it's a very big train. And so, what do we need to do over what period of time to bring the science up so that we've got good answers? And I think it's the so what in Andy's very good idea.
Yeah, right on. That's, again, very much in tune with what we are attending to and intend to do as well. Board Member Kissinger.
Tom, one question about Marinwood, and I recognize the limits on what can and should be said, but I just want to understand one piece factually, and maybe it was covered when Mr. Nessel was speaking. My power went out at that point. That's why I dropped off the Zoom call. I'm sitting in the darkness at home. Luckily, I've got a laptop that I'm working from. But the question I had was this, in terms of the factual discussion, you recount how the remedy to deal with soil contamination has changed. And you talk about how last summer, you mentioned in August, the PRPs decided to switch from demolition to soil vapor extraction. And then in December, they switched back to demolition. And you know, the schedule's due out sometime this month. I'm curious to know when the original remedy of demolition was first determined. When did they decide to do that? When did we approve that?
Okay, I'll ask Alec Noggle to answer that question.
Thanks, Tom.
Yeah, thank you, Tom. Yeah, I'm Alec Noggle, chief of our toxics cleanup division. The that was submitted through a series of follow-ups to a task on the old an older order that is no longer in place. It was approved in 2019, and the soil excavation and building demolition plan, as it was then approved, was we had expected a completion report for that. I believe it was March of 2020, and that did not come in, and that precipitated other events, including updating the order, which we brought to you in September of 2020. So that's essentially the plan that they are reverting to now. We believe we don't have the details or the schedule, as you've noted.
Is there any scenario under which they would switch back to soil vapor extraction?
At this point, I think they would. Well, they would face very stiff resistance from the community and probably from us to be flip-flopping in this manner. We don't know the details of why they reverted back to soil excavation. I can presume it has to do with property use and values and things of that nature. Because the timing of soil excavation is faster and quicker than, say, soil vapor extraction.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Alan.
Okay. I want to use this opportunity to call the attention to the board that this will be our last virtual board meeting, because the executive order that allows us to operate this way expires at the end of March. So starting in April, all the public entity meetings have to be open to the public, and you will have to meet in a public setting. And with that end, where we are planning to have the April board meeting in the auditorium in the state building. The challenge, however, is that we want the future board meetings to be what's now becoming known as hybrid meetings, which would allow in-person as well as remote participation. The challenge we have is that the auditorium does not have adequate bandwidth to support the virtual meeting, but we are working with the building to remedy that. I'm hopeful, but being cautious about whether that can happen by April, and to hedge your bets, we're looking at other possible local locations that might be available for us that would allow for the hybrid meeting. So we'll keep you tuned in. Right now, we are public noticing that our meetings will be in the auditorium, but we will follow up as need be. So it's kind of given that you will all meet in person, and but the public will have the opportunity to participate remotely. You would have the opportunity, if you so choose, to participate remotely, but to do so, your location will have to be public noticed and open to the public. So it is possible if you wanted to do that. And so that's just FYI, we're transitioning into the post-pandemic world that we're all gonna have to adapt to. Any questions on that? Kind of just wanted to make sure you all knew. So
I love, Tom, this is just an aside, I love that the challenge you're facing is going back to business as usual.
Yeah, well, indeed. Yeah, we are still yet to determine, and there will, we are anticipating some direction from Sacramento on going back to some form of in-office work beyond the current sort of emergency telework mode. We anticipate that phasing in over the next couple months, but we don't have anything specific yet about.
I just also mentioned, yes, it's exciting to hear that we're going back to in-person, but it's also interesting to think about the opportunities this might present. You know, our region is geographically so large that, you know, if people can join remotely, we can be in any location, you know, we could be in any location. Anyway, I'm just thinking it might give us more of an opportunity to meet in person in different places around the region.
That's something we will discuss. Yes, that does.
I've been this great meeting room in Half Moon Bay at this farm. It's really a beautiful spot.
I was actually thinking of all those incredibly well-wired rooms in Silicon Valley and elsewhere that you know, are very set up to do a hybrid Zoom-based sort of location. Or Bill's office.
Happy to do it. I'm all not sure that my firm wants to, all the public coming in, though.
So now, transitioning to something important, different but important for your, to want you to know, and also we're communicating to the public through this, is that two key people who are part of our water board staff family are leaving, and I want to bring that to your attention. First, I want to call attention to Terry Seward, who is retiring. This is his last week in the office, and he will be officially retiring a little bit later. But I want to just call attention to Terry, because who's worked at the board for over 30 years, and the last 13 years he's led. He's been division chief of the Groundwater Protection Division. And what's really noteworthy about Terry is that he's quiet, but he's strong. He makes things happen. He doesn't draw attention to himself, in part because he gets things done behind the scenes. He's very skilled in rules and policies associated with groundwater contamination, and under his division oversees all the Department of Defense and the Department of Energy contaminated sites, the industrial contaminated sites, landfills, and as well as sharing the site other site cleanup. So a lot goes on there. Also very noteworthy about Terry is he's just real nice, and staff love him. His division has always had great morale in terms of very much affected by his leadership style. So we always appreciate that, staff do. He's always has this kind of unique sense of humor, which it's always well, very welcome. So personally, I'm going to miss Terry. He's been a great part of our team. We'll certainly, the organization will miss him. But yeah, he's served us well. So just wanted to bring that to your attention, that Terry's leaving, unfortunately.
It's terrible news, but I hope we'll give him the appropriate send-off when it happens. When does that happen?
Well, Terry, you know, I don't care if you want to say something, but he's officially not retiring until August because he's got some leave balance to take care of. So that's why this is his last work week.
Officially August 1st will be my last day in the office. But I just want to thank you, Tom. You've done an outstanding job at the Water Board. And there's a lot of people to thank for my time at the Water Board, especially you board members for your commitment to protecting the region's waters, you know, which we all know is such a vital resource of our region. And I especially thank you for your direction and support of Water Board staff over the years. Even though the makeup of the board has changed during my time at the Water Board, there's always been one thing that's been consistent, and that's the support from the board of the staff. And that's really important, and staff really appreciate that. I just say it's been a great privilege and honor for me to work for the San Francisco Water Board, where I've dedicated, you know, most of my career to public service at the Water Board. And I'm really grateful to have that opportunity to be here with just great, great people to work with. I especially want to thank my division seniors, David, Keith, Nathan, and Ross, and all the division staff. I'm really humbled by all the hard work they do every day to fulfilling the board's mission. It's really important, and they just roll up their sleeves and get things done. Yeah, I also want to thank our attorneys, Yuri and Marnie. They've done a great job with their legal advice and keeping things rolling. And the entire executive team really has just been great to work with, and their dedication to the region has been really strong. So yeah, basically I'm looking forward to spending more time with my family, you know, traveling and learning new things, doing fun stuff. And yeah, I just want to thank you guys all very much. It's been a great run for me. Thank you.
We wish you well, Terry. Thank you.
Go ahead. All right, and then he actually mentioned somebody who I'm not now going to call attention to next, because he thanked Marnie. But, it's my responsibility to inform you that Marnie Ayala is also leaving Water Board service. She, as you may know, she has family in New England, and she's been spending a considerable amount of time during the pandemic there. And not surprising, she found a great job, perhaps an offer she couldn't refuse, with I believe it's the Department of Interior in Boston. So she will be leaving as well very, very soon. Marty, you can perhaps tell the board exactly when I think your last date is after next week, something like that. So again, Marty, was like, no, when she called me and told me this, how it was kind of struck me strongly, felt it in the heart, Marty, because you know how well we love you and how you engage with us. You're an excellent lawyer, but also an excellent person, and I was very pleasant to work with, we're going to miss you. And but really, really, I want to thank you on behalf of staff of all the great legal counsel and just human interest. You know, one of the things that Marty brings board members when she does engage with us and stuff, she asks lots of questions. She gets passionate about the sort of the people issues and facts going on, facts related to the stuff we're doing. So it's part of the fun. The fun interactions that we have with Marty. So again, thank you, Marty.
Thank you, Tom. After all these years, it's still very nerve-wracking to talk in front of the big audience, but I had a wonderful 6.5 years with the board. I've learned so much from everyone, especially Yuri. And I'm excited for this next step. As Tom mentioned, I'll be closer to my family. I'll be in Boston. But I'll definitely miss California, and I'll miss the San Francisco Bay region specifically a lot. So thank you.
This meeting was going so well, and it's just going downhill and downhill. Come on, Tom.
Marty, we're going to miss you, and all the best to you in Boston. I grew up in New England, went to school in Boston, and I love it back there too. So enjoy, and so glad to be near family.
Thank you.
So, Marty, I know you're really going to miss the Bay Area next year about January 15th. You're going to go, oh, my God, what did I give up for this? No, I've worked with dozens of attorneys over my almost 50 years of doing this, and they've managed to keep me out of trouble. And as you can attest, that's not an easy thing to do. And I've always enjoyed your competence and your help. But if I had to think about one thing that I hope you never change, it's your winning smile. You are just such a cheerful person, and it really does make a difference. Please don't ever change, and good luck.
Thank you.
Okay, well, that's the end of my executive officer's report. And Board Member Kissinger, good news is the next item is a uplifting.
Good.
And Chair McGrath, do you want to just, Bobby, just
keep going, Tom?
Okay, well, the
take it away.
So the next item is a pleasant surprise that we, the board, in conjunction with the Bay Area Clean Water Agencies, have received a national award from the National Association of Clean Water Agencies. So that's the national version of BAQA, the Bay Area Clean Water Agencies. And they're recognizing the collaborative spirit that affects how we do regulation here in the Bay Area. It's the rest of the country, it's just amazed at what we can accomplish through our approach. Wes, could you put up the first slide? So I just want to remind you what this is about. So we're getting recognized for the board action which you acted on November of 2020, where we amended the basin plan to include a new water quality objective for residual chlorine that would be protective of the bay, but it would allow us to reform, essentially update how we regulate residual chlorine discharges in NPDES permits. So I call your attention to that middle box. The problem is that the current requirement is technology-based, established many, many years ago to essentially eliminate chlorine resid in the discharge to the extent you can through technology to avoid the consequence of chlorine, which is a toxic substance affecting the bay. But in the context of most dischargers wanting to avoid non-compliance, there is often, just in case, they use a substantial amount of dechlor chemicals, which fortunately don't have the consequence of chlorine on aquatic life, but still a substantial amount of extra chemical being discharged into the bay at cost that we can't finally realize time to reform that. So the new water quality objective allows us to now in the future include water quality based effluent limits that will account for mixing of the discharge such that the water quality objective will be met past some minimal mixing zone. And we'll also improve how chlorine resid is monitored, so it's more cost effective and smart, and result in substantial reduction in unnecessary use of dechlor chemical. So it's great for the environment, great for the dischargers, great for the community. So this did catch me quite by surprise, but not so, because one of our great partners is BAQA, is East Bay Mud, and their director of wastewater, Eileen White, is a big promoter of our collaborative approach to regulation and joint fact-finding basis to getting good science to inform smart regulation. So she is continually advocating in our interests nationally. And so she put forward the recommendation and actually received the reward for us. So I'm going to turn the mic over to Eileen to take us home on the receipt of the reward. So Eileen White, Director of Wastewater of East Bay Mud.
Great. Thank you so much, Tom. And good morning, Chair McGrath and members of the board.
Wes, can you go back to the other slide first before you put this back up? So, yeah. Sure.
Great. Thanks. So good morning. So as Tom mentioned, East Bay Mud is a member of the National Association of Clean Water Agencies, also known as NACWA. NACWA is the nation's recognized leader in legislative, regulatory, and clean water advocacy. And the goal is to help build a resilient and sustainable clean water future. It's very similar to the regional board's goals. NACWA awarded the National Environmental Achievement Award in the Watershed Collaboration category in recognition of the collaboration between the San Francisco Bay Regional Water Quality Control Board and the Bay Area Clean Water Agencies to implement a regulatory change to reduce chemical overdosing to San Francisco Bay. Public agencies that operate wastewater treatment plants and the regional boards that oversee them share a common goal of environmental protection. However, there is typically a trade-off between environmental protection and cost. On rare occasions, an opportunity comes along where environmental protection and ratepayer savings goals align. This occurred when BAQA and the regional board collaborated on changes to the San Francisco Bay Basin Plan to make a slight tweak to the total chlorine limit, resulting in cost savings, reduced greenhouse gas emissions associated with making the chemical and trucking it to the various wastewater treatment plants, and improved water quality for San Francisco Bay. By incorporating the change in the basin plan rather than individual permits, the benefits are realized uniformly and with minimal additional effort. These benefits include savings of about 1.2 million yearly due to the reduction in the use of sodium bisulfite by about 30% each year. And that's because all the operators want to make sure that they meet their NPDES permits and do not have chlorine going to San Francisco Bay. I am proud and honored to present the NACA Award to the San Francisco Regional Water Board for their collaboration with the dischargers, resulting in a true win-win for the environment and for the Bay Area's 7 million ratepayers. This innovative approach in solving a common practical issue is an exceptional example demonstrating how the regulators and the regulated can work together to best manage a critically important ecosystem and serves as a national model. Thank you.
So Wes, you can put up the slide, shows the virtual picture of the award.
Thank and I can so deliver much. It, Tom, now that I, wherever you're going for your next board meeting in April, I'll make sure I get it to you because I have it in my office here, Tom. So I can deliver it to you personally, but because this was virtual, we put the picture up.
Thank you. All right.
Eileen, thank you for your kind words and for the nomination and for the collaborative spirit. Any questions or comments from the rest of the board? All right. Bill, was that you?
Yeah, I just said it's terrific. That's great. That is good news, Tom.
And I just want to say we really enjoy working with them. We really enjoy working with the regional board staff. You've got a great team there. And they're very collaborative, and we really appreciate working with Tom and everybody at the regional board to find win-win solutions.
Chair McGrath, before you, I just wanted just from a personal perspective, and of course my active engagement in these type of efforts and watching what we do compared to what comparable organizations do. And what's important to note is it's not that we, through this collaboration, we are making things easy for dischargers just for the sake of making things easy for them. We actually get more done, more good actions happen as a result of this approach versus what we otherwise could be limited by just what can be forced. So I think a lot of you know the philosophy of getting things to happen through engaging people, getting them to do the right thing versus forcing them to do the right thing and not have ownership of it. So I feel really good about how much we accomplish in a overall through the, and then get this recognition is just sort of the unnecessary pat on the back because we do it because it's doable. And so we like doing doable things.
Here, this brings us to item 6 on the agenda, but before we actually do that, we want to swear in all those that might testify. All relevant evidence that any person desires to be considered by this board must be introduced at this hearing, first by the board staff, second by the discharger, third by public agencies, and fourth by any other interested parties. The board and council may ask questions to clarify the testimony of a witness at any time. Cross-examination of any witness by others will be allowed following completion of direct testimony by all persons. Each person testifying will commence by stating his or her name, whom he or she represents, and whether he or she took the oath to tell the truth. The hearings will not be conducted according to technical rules of evidence. Instead, the board will accept any evidence or testimony that is reasonably relevant to the issues. All board files, exhibits, or testimony that is reasonably relevant to this matter will be made part of the record of this process. Additional written material will be made part of the record at the discretion of the board. Those wishing to testify in this hearing will now raise their hands. Do you promise to tell the truth?
Yes.
All right, that brings us to the two uncontested items. Tom, can you introduce them, please?
Yes, one is the reissuance of the City of Calistoga's NPDES permit. And the other is updates to waste discharge requirements for what's for the West County landfill. It's the West Contra Costa County landfill in the North Richmond area. Both items remain uncontested.
And Tom, you were not planning on a presentation, is that correct?
No presentation, no. So then,
Wesley, are there any?
There are representatives from both both entities if the board has questions, though, or staff, or we have staff available as well.
So I'll turn to the board first and ask if there are any questions or comments.
Like Alexis has her hand up.
Alexis, go ahead.
I don't have questions because Tom had responded to some earlier prep questions that I had, but I wanted to just offer commendations to this facility and its team for the nature of the upgrades that they've been investing in. I think in the fact sheet, for example, there are at least four very significant things in F9 that to me made a big difference. And I think how they dealt with disinfection byproducts, improving their storage capacity for recycled water, all of the things they've done to reduce INI, for example, and their source control actions and how they're dealing with the ponds. I just thought it was exemplary to see this kind of investment in the facility going forward that we tend to capture at the time of a permit renewal. So I just wanted to recognize that. Thank you.
And just to clarify for the record, Board Member Hacker was speaking about the City of Calistoga's wastewater and collection system.
Clearly.
I have a few comments on the West Contra Costa County sanitary landfill. When I read this, I thought it was a hot mess. There are things here in terms of practice that while the staff report has provided a pathway out of those problems, they're pretty disturbing. Fill on top of the closure of a landfill has the potential to rupture the aquicludes that are constructed to contain that. It's not entirely clear how many fill. In some places it says 8, 10 feet. Sometimes it says up to 31 feet of material above the waste at the top. There are signs that are very disturbing of leakage outside, which may indicate the breach. As a management of a facility, after all the good work done in these other arenas, I must say I'm very disappointed. And I want to make that very clear. There is a proposal by the staff and a recommendation that I'm not going to ask for any changes, but I am going to say these deadlines really need to be met, all of them. So, I really like to be in a position where I am praising the efforts and the management efforts of our dischargers. I've been one. I know it's difficult. And I know solid waste is a hard thing, but this game needs to be improved. So those are my comments. With that, if there are no further comments, I'd like a motion to approve the uncontested calendar.
I'll move. Bill Kissinger.
And a second.
I'll second, Donald.
Thank you, Board Member Young. Julie, would you call the roll, please?
Of course. Board Member Young.
Aye.
Board Member Gunther.
Aye.
Board Member Hacker.
Aye.
Board Member Kissinger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Batty.
Aye.
Chair McGrath.
Aye. So ordered. This brings us to the last item on our current agenda, the informational item. And I'm happy to see in the audience A.L. Riley, one of the first people that I talked to when I was appointed as a board member. Tom, go ahead and introduce the item. And
okay, thank you. I'm actually going to call on Keith Licton to actually introduce the item. So let's just expedite that, Keith. Just take it over.
All right, sounds good. Thanks, Tom. Good morning. I'm Keith Licton, the Chief of the Watershed Management Division here at the board, and it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Ann Riley, who many of you know. Riley is working with us as a retired annuitant. As you know, she's one of the founders of the Urban Creeks Daylighting Movement. Her nonprofit work restoring creeks, along with her work with state agencies, with the Department of Water Resources, the State Department of Fish and Wildlife, and with us, have given her a unique perspective on the regulatory design and performance challenges associated with building flood management projects. And that includes particularly those projects where the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is playing a substantial role. To assist project proponents and agency staff, Riley has prepared two circulars, which are guidance documents for good flood project design and permit application review. Today's presentation reflects on the benefits of essentially that are in those circulars, shifting from gray to green infrastructure, and considering the increased urgency of climate change, thinking about incorporating that into flood management projects. And Riley will give some examples taken from the circular, intended to help project proponents design projects that protect water quality and that are easy to permit. Following Riley's talk, we have three speakers, Tom Kendall from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, Rick Thomaser from Napa Flood, and John Bourgeois from the Santa Clara Valley Water District. With that, Riley, let me hand it over to you to give the talk. And AGP, I understand you have Riley's presentation teed up.
Hello, everybody. Can you hear me okay? All right. Notice that this presentation was assisted by the Watershed Stewardship Program, AmeriCorps volunteers. Next slide. The purpose of this presentation is really to raise your awareness of these two circulars. One was produced in 2003, and this latest one, 2016. And what they do is explain to the public and our permit applicants the connection between good, healthy streams and rivers and their conditions with the water quality that we need to protect. Next slide. And we provide specific guidance on how to look at reducing floods and erosion from streams so that we don't have conflicts between water quality and flood control. Next slide. The environmental considerations that we have in how we handle rivers and streams have to do with one of the greatest sources of pollution is from runoff from farms and cities, next slide, that go into our streams. Next slide. An interesting field trip I took to the Santa Monica Urban Runoff Recycling Facility, where this facility is brick and mortar, but it does the same thing as a healthy riparian corridor. It takes up nutrients, it moderates temperatures, it stores sediment, it reduces turbidity, it improves dissolved oxygen, and it even reduces bacteria. But look, the cost of this plant annualizes at about $1.3 million per year. So that, you know, the idea of actually a brick and mortar plant doing the functions of nature is pretty expensive. Next slide. Next slide. So I compared that against a stream restoration project, a creek that has basically on a daily basis, the amount of water going through it as this plant does. And the annualized cost of this project is about $950,000. However, it doesn't have those long-term maintenance costs of the plant. So one of the goals that we have in our water board program is basically to protect streams, to protect our water quality plants. Next slide. Beneficial uses include that we need to protect through the Port Cologne Act, include aquatic and fish habitat. And so our staff spend a reasonable amount of time sitting down with our partners, the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, National Marine Fisheries Service, and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to make sure we're looking at the whole picture. Next slide. Next slide. One of my colleagues at the Water Board insists in my public education PowerPoints that we emphasize that we need to put an overlay on our stream protection efforts for anadromous fishery habitats. They require a different kind of habitat, low-hanging vegetation. The riparian area needs to be quite dense, to provide them the fish with feeding and predator safety. Next slide. And next slide. Here we have our anadromous fisheries crashing and burning. And so this is the only place these fish have to live is in our streams. And so we need to make an extra effort for those salmon streams. Next slide. This is a whole series of slides of dramatic mistakes we've made over the 30 to 40 years in conventional flood control design. Next slide. The issue is we need to avoid these mistakes and that good engineering is good water quality. One of the most famous project failures was the San Lorenzo River in Santa Cruz. The river used to be the width that you see there that's got the wetted perimeter. And it was widened in order to carry more floods during more water during the floods. And they had terrible floods in the 50s and 60s here. By widening the river during low and moderate flows, there wasn't enough stream power to move the sediment through. So the sediment filled up the channel. And so in the 82, 86, and subsequent floods, that river overtopped the banks at about the 10 to 25 year floods. Next slide. Coromandel Creek was another famous example of a conventional engineering failure. It was supposed to provide one in 200 year protection, but the models being used really didn't take into account sediment transport. And there's so much sediment in this water that it slowed the water down so that the design volume wasn't attained in these channels. Next slide. There's a slide of the overflow in the 82 and 86 floods in Marin County. Next slide. This precipitated a public revolt. This was referred to as the Housewives Environmental Revolt of 1969. Women met in their living rooms. They said, we've got to stop the destruction of this Coromandel Creek system. Barbara Boxer was one of the housewife revolters. She was so upset at what was going on that she ran for county supervisor. And later, the pinnacle of her career as a U.S. senator representing California, chaired the Environment and Public Works Committee in the Senate and became a well-known reformer for this kind of conventional flood control project. I read a firsthand account just very recently of what these demonstrations were like. And these women put the shins of their legs between the trees and the chainsaws to stop these projects. One of the heavy equipment operators in one of these demonstrations turned off his machine and walked off the site and said, you guys are right. Next slide. This is a slide from Orange County, conventional flood control project with concrete lining. And here, what you're seeing is big chunks of concrete lining just being strewn up and thrown downstream because of the lack of looking into natural stream processes for these streams. Next slide. Closer to home, this is San Pablo Creek in Orinda with concrete lining failure. That city is still trying to deal with taking these linings out and coming up with a different creek for their downtown. Next slide. And the 88-89 floods was really a wake-up call for the California Department of Water Resources. Over 300 levees were breached in the Sacramento-San Joaquin River system. And so what that did was precipitate more of a setback levee floodplain restoration approach at the state level. Next slide. One of the popular stream modification measures has been to take out meanders and put in weirs like this or grade control structures. Next slide, if you look at the kinds of impacts from this, these weirs or grade control structures capture sediment. The water going over these little dams is called hungry water. And the water picks up the sediment, it just dropped behind the dams and the sections downstream. The nonprofit I work with is helping property owners in Contra Costa County deal with stream bank stabilization issues. And we found that 25% of the bank failures are due to these grade control structures and weirs. Next slide. Next slide. Another weir, this is down towards San Diego, that was put in with the idea it would catch sediment, would raise the bottom of this creek and try to help the bank erosion. What happens is, yes, they do catch sediment, that flattens the grade because the stream is so much more flattened, it induces meandering. And so we have a bunch of weirs that are just sticking out in the middle of space, creating damage. Next slide. One of the circulars describes these processes of failure so that people can better understand why this happens. If you look at that last cross section, you can see how the creek is eroding around a grade control structure. Next slide. Example of gabion failures. This is from the South Bay. Gabions were very popular in the 80s or 90s. They're wire baskets full of rock. The whole idea was, well, we could plant these instead of using concrete. The red arrow is pointing to the concrete apron that's supposed to hold them up. And it failed about 3 months after this gabion project was put in. And next slide. Again, the mechanism for failure here was when we harden the banks of a stream, the only place the sediment has to, or the creek has to pick up sediment that it typically transport is concentrated on the bottom of the creek. And what happens is the incision just undercuts the bank stabilization. Next slide. Articulated concrete blocks were the salesman came through the Bay Area in the 90s saying, this is a great product. You all need to buy this for your stream bank stabilization projects. You can have your cake and eat it too. It's concrete, but it's got holes in it. Because it's got holes in it, you can put vegetation in it. Widespread failures of this particular product. And Harris County Flood Control District in Houston drove me along hundreds of miles of failures of this kind of product. Next slide. My career in California started out at the California Department of Water Resources under Jerry Brown I. We were involved in riprapping the Sacramento River to protect walnut groves. And some graduate students from UC Davis floated down the river and pointed out to us that we were getting riprap islands in the middle of the river because the river was just meandering right around the riprap. And also the riprap blew out the banks both upstream and downstream and on the opposite banks. So the Department of Water Resources realized early on that we were going to have to look at a meander belt protection strategy for the Sacramento River. Next slide. And this failure mechanism occurs on small creeks. This is a photo of a small creek in Richmond. Next slide. The local or non-federal sponsors who work with the Corps on many of these projects started reporting to the Corps about these problems. And so the Corps was motivated to go out and start to evaluate the performance issues of their projects and came up with this report in 1990 that showed, yes, the weirs, the grade control structures, the riprap, the hydraulic structures had way too high failure rates. Next slide. And what's so incredible about this story, next slide, is that the solutions started to present themselves shortly after. This is a manual put out by 16 federal agencies, just 8 or 9 years later. Imagine 16 federal agencies agreeing on one publication. And this set us off on a whole new framework for how we should handle streams and rivers. Next slide. Next slide. Now the top cross section, okay, this, can you go back one slide? The top cross section shows the conventional flood control project that we had all over the Bay Area in the 50s and 60s. We turned streams into squares, rectangles, and trapezoids. There was no life in the streams. The whole idea was to make the water go as fast as possible, to put a larger volume of water through it at a lower stage. The next case I'm going to talk about is the Wildcat Creek flood control project. What that did was take the same cross-sectional area, but put a natural functioning stream in the middle of it, and attain 100-year flood protection. The final cross-section represents what we did on the Napa River, which was really to restore the river and the floodplain as a mechanism of flood control. Next slide. Next slide. This is the Wildcat Creek project. It is located in a poverty African-American community at the time. In the 70s, 98% of the households were at poverty or below poverty levels. A public revolt against this project happened in 1982. And so we have the demographics of the Barber Boxer crowd in Marin doing their revolt in 1969, but this is a very different demographics across the Bay of people who had mud and water in their houses every other year, but they organized to stop this channelization project. Next slide. Next slide. So what was proposed was this trapezoidal channel, and it violated their model cities plan. That was a poverty, anti-poverty program from the 70s, and there was a lot of citizen participation in developing that plan, where they saw the creek as a way of bringing in an environmental magnet school and recreation as a way of bringing back the viability of their impoverished community. This project had a low flow channel that was sized the right width and depth to transport the sediment through so it wouldn't drop out like it did in San Lorenzo, with a floodplain to store the flood flows. And again, I'm going to repeat that this project used the same right of way as the top project. So nobody had to relocate to make this more environmental alternative viable. Next slide. Next slide. The citizen drawing to stop the Army Corps project. This alternative was really adopted ultimately because of endangered species considerations, was adopted as the logo for the federal flood control channel research program of the Army Corps of Engineers located in Vicksburg. Next slide. So this community had a profound impact on national flood control design guidance. And an important lesson was the use of a watershed council that brought to the table federal, state, local representatives, staffs, and community members. And as a matter of fact, Jim McGrath attended one of our watershed council meetings, which really in our 40th year of existence. Next slide. So this is what this channel looks like that's shaped correctly to move the sediment through so a poverty community doesn't have to keep paying to dig it out. Next slide. And the floodplain area captures these very high floods. This project has performed really well through over 20 years of flooding. Next slide. One of the benefits of an approach like this was the Wildcat Creek project has provided decades of youth training and jobs for North Richmond and disadvantaged youth. Next slide. Another important solution has been to address undersized railroad trestles and bridges. Union Pacific Railroad came to the water board wanting to get a permit to put new tracks in, and the San Francisco Regional Water Board required that they replace this trestle, next slide, with 5 culverts. This was to avoid flooding over the railroad, flooding all the way down to Gilman, the freeway, and having fish stranded on top of the railroad tracks. Next slide. So the lesson here is trying to look at what the causes of these floods are as opposed to just damaging the streams. University of California, starting in the 90s, wanted to redevelop University Village around Cornelius Creek. And they wanted a channelization project, but actually the water board had an important role here, imploring that the university not use that approach. And we show here what the stream really needed to be a functioning stream with a floodplain to reduce floods. Yes, we did meander into some parking spaces and some units, but next slide, ultimately, the university realized they could move buildings away from the creek and they could move the development envelope back 15 feet. Next slide. This is what this particular site looks like today with a restored stream of floodplain creek access. Way over on the right is a trail, and the post office moved its wall back 10 feet to make room for that trail. Next slide. Now, the Napa River flood control project, I think a lot of board members are familiar with, but that really looked at relocating a lot of structures along the floodplain and restoring floodplain. Next slide. But an important strategy as well was to remove these hydraulic constrictions, as I'm calling them. The Third Street Bridge, which was too low, created backup flooding in the community. It was replaced by, next slide. Next slide, please. A bridge like this. A number of bridges were replaced along the Napa River and Napa Creek. Next slide. Next slide. And a very important benefit of this multi-objective project was to restore the downtown economy and attract tourists. An article I read in the San Francisco Chronicle by John King pointed out that a lot of this construction was done about 2015, and by 2017, over $550 million of private investment happened in downtown. You have to worry about what you ask for sometimes, because my friends in Napa seemed a little overwhelmed with tourists at this point. Next slide. Napa Creek was an important part of this project. This is a typical bank failure shot. Rick Thomaser is going to talk about this in more detail later. Next slide. Another gory stream bank failure shot on Napa Creek. Next slide. And that red circle is where that bank failure was occurring in the last slide. Now this, what you're looking at is soil bioengineering. By 2000 and 2007, the Army Corps of Engineers flood control design manuals and also the Natural Resources Conservation Service flood control design manuals introduced specifications for taking willows, dogwood, and other plants and bundling them and installing them in these projects in a certain way to provide bank stabilization. Dr. Donald Gray, an engineer who was chair of the University of Michigan Engineering Department, published a book in 1996 that basically found, he combined mechanical engineering with plant physiology, but he found that the tensile strength of the roots of these soil bioengineering systems were equal to or greater than the tensile strength of concrete. Next slide. Rick will talk about this more. You can see the habitat in this Army Corps of Engineer flood control project in downtown Napa. Next slide. And part of that habitat was moved into by beaver. And beaver went from and the public loves beaver. So the people in Napa go down to look at their Napa Creek deep beaver. But beaver also moved into downtown Martinez in Alhambra Creek. And this created a big stir because people associate beaver with flood damages. So some beaver deceivers and caster masters were applied. They fooled the beaver into putting in lower dams. Napa County has been, flood control has been very good at communicating with the public as well as Contra Costa County flood control at this point on how once you have floods come through, they just take out the beaver dams. So the flooding issue generally goes away. And so I'm very grateful to the flood control districts who are this important interface between beaver and the public. And beaver are now being considered very important allies in creating wetlands for water conservation and backwater flooding areas for different areas in the Bay Area. Next slide. Ah, we're now in the era of removing concrete from flood control projects. Next slide. A dramatic example of this is Santa Rosa Creek in downtown Santa Rosa. This project you're looking at was done in the mid 60s. Next slide. And the city of Santa Rosa took the initiative to jackhammer up the bottom of the concrete channel, allow habitat to come back and grow along the creek. They integrated bike trails. Another important point here is they did not need to add right away to make this environmental project happen. Okay, next slide. There it is, handling the one of the flood of records in downtown Santa Rosa. Next slide. And that's what it looks like very recently. I took a walk along the creek. Next slide. Concrete failures in downtown city of San Pablo near 23rd Street. Next slide. Next slide. Concrete coming out. Next slide. Concrete is substituted with soil bioengineering, handling flood flow, a 25-year flood immediately after it was installed. Next slide. A failing bank in Marin County. Gabion's falling apart. This is a vertical bank. Next slide. You see the soil bioengineering system up close here. The plants are woven in and out of the soil. These are branches cut off of willow and pounded into the embankment. Next slide. That's the soil bioengineering growing up. Next slide. And that's what it looks like today, a nice pretty creek going through that area. And that is the end of my presentation. Thank you.
Great.
Thank you. Should we have the next speakers before we turn to the board?
Well, Chair McGrath, I think it's up to you. Each of the speakers coming up, the three, will speak for about 5 to 7 minutes. So there could be some Q&A now, or we could hold Q&A until they finished.
Let's hold Q&A and just complete the presentation.
Great. Okay, well, with that, I'd like to introduce Tom Kendall from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And Wes, I think you have Tom's slides. Let's see, has Tom been promoted?
Yeah, can you all hear me?
Yes, we can. Thanks, Tom. So, Tom, I'm going to hand it off to you.
I apologize. I actually dressed up for this, but apparently the government filters have me only doing Zoom from the browser version, and I can't figure out how to get the video to work on the browser version of Zoom. So, anyhow, there is a face behind that name. While I'm sort of in tangent mode here, I just got to ask Dr. Riley a quick question. Does she know Wesley Wong? Because for some reason, my screen, when it says, I am viewing Wesley Wong's screen, which that's an old surfer buddy of mine, and I just have no idea why this Zoom image thinks it's Wesley Wong's screen. But anyhow, I'm going to assume that's a random phenomenon.
Tom, Wes is our IT support staff, and he is actually sharing his screen.
Wow. Okay. I'm guessing that's the Wesley I know. How about that? Okay. There's not a lot of Wesley Wongs out there. Okay, cool. So that would make more sense, right? It would be the water board, not and stuff there. Okay. So I'm here largely just to kind of remind you who the Corps is and talk about some recent changes in our planning process that tie in a little bit with where I think Dr. Riley's presentation was going. Do you want to go to the next slide, please? Okay, so these are, you know, our quote missionaries, generally speaking. And the one that overlaps mostly with Dr. Riley's presentation is the flood risk management one. And what she's been pioneering for some time now could be categorized as quote engineering with nature. So we're on the next slide, right? Sorry, I switched to another screen here, so I'm not seeing. We're on the our missions generally slide, right?
That's right, yes.
Yeah. So anyhow, we call that EWN because we love our acronyms in the Corps. And at the San Francisco District, we're excited to actually be serving as one of six, quote, proving grounds for EWN within the Corps nationwide. And the photo you see here is probably familiar to many of you. This is our Hamilton Field Restoration Project that we did with the Coastal Conservancy in the Port of Oakland. And it's an example of our, quote, restoration mission using dredge material generated from our navigation mission. And quickly, just a little props to the Water Board. Speaking of our navigation mission, we're really pleased to have their CEQA leadership right now on our strategic placement of dredge material pilot project. And this is a project that's intended to demonstrate the cost-effective nourishment of mudflats and marshes using dredge material placed, you know, where it's not too expensive to drop it, but it ideally feeds those other systems. And then the fourth bullet on this slide is talking about the planning process that governs everything we do in the Corps when we're trying to get these projects authorized. We have to go through a rather rigorous planning process, and that is still governed by something way back from the 80s. It was, it's called the Economic and Environmental Principles for Water and Related Land Resources Implementation Studies, inhale, which was signed by Reagan. So that is still what governs what we do, but there was an attempt to update this came out, it was called the Principles, Requirements, and Guidelines. It was published by the Council on Environmental Quality in 2013, but Congress was a little concerned that those new principles were a little too environmentally leaning, and that they were going to have us building a lot of things that weren't all about, you know, the bottom dollar in terms of economic justification. And so we were actually not funded to develop what's called the agency-specific procedures for years, just to kind of keep this more holistic approach on the shelf a little longer. Well, I'm pleased to report that we actually are now funded to develop those procedures. We expect rulemaking to happen on that later this year. So that's really maybe the bigger news, but we don't know exactly what the light will look like at the end of this that particular tunnel. But we're getting some hints. So just to share what's currently defining our practice, it's still what we call the four accounts that come from the original principles and guidelines from the 80s. And if you go to the next slide, please. So these are they. It's the first and foremost historically is the national economic development. This is your biggest bang for the buck to the national economy, as opposed to the regional economy, which shows up as your third bullet. You know, sometimes what's good for the region just means a benefit transfer from some other region to your region. And so from a national perspective, that's not considered a benefit, but obviously it still is to the region. So anyhow, we're supposed to characterize the regional economic perks, but they definitely take a second seat to the national. And then also what you see here is environmental quality and other social effects. Other social effects is where we capture things like public safety, environmental justice, things like that. So you'll see a footnote that indicates that national economic development, or NED as we call it, is still the path of least resistance. If you want to recommend something other than that quote NED plan, we need approval all the way up to the secretariat level to do that. But Assistant Secretary of the Army, that same entity we have to get approval from, next slide, please, produced a memo last year. And this is where I talk about maybe some hints as to what the light at the end of the tunnel might look like. And this basically encouraged us to take a more holistic approach. And we were actually encouraged to produce what we call a comprehensive benefits plan. In other words, a plan that maximizes outputs across all four accounts. Now, if that, and we're allowed to, you know, in so doing, we treat each of those accounts equally. So it's quite a sea change from, you know, NED is king to, well, yeah, tell us what your NED plan is, but we also want to know what you would recommend if you weren't obsessed with NED. And if what we would recommend as a comprehensive benefits plan is not coincidentally also the National Economic Development Plan, because that would be very simple if it was, but if it's not, we still have this, you know, permission requirement where we have to run approval or get approval from the Assistant Secretary of the Army's office. But what was new here is that same office that issues the approvals was actually encouraging us to put in such requests. So next slide, please. This is just a graphic showing what this means on a typical core study. You've got your four quadrants, national economic development, environmental quality, regional, and other social effects. And you can see in the little bullets out each of those what that kind of typically would allow us to recognize in terms of outputs or benefits. And then in the little scripty thing off to the right there, you know, it says we must identify which plan maximizes the benefits across all categories. So again, we're being encouraged to identify the plan. It's not a slam dunk that it would be approved, but they want to see this. And to the extent they want to see it, it's obviously queuing up this idea that we're going to be potentially sending some request to have these comprehensive benefits plans approved over, quote, NED plans going forward. Next slide. This is just an example, and I don't know if we're going to get into super detailed questions in any of this, but I was trying to make Daria Macy available if there were detailed questions. This is a slide from Daria. She's the lead planner on the Upper Guadalupe River project. This is, you know, nominally a single purpose project where, you know, it's all about flood risk management. That's how it was authorized. We're trying to figure out the best way to build that thing, given the authorization on the books versus the situation we have on the ground. And you can just see in, you know, I apologize for the fine print there, but the kinds of measures that are being considered, you know, in the interest of floodplain connectivity and so on, as part of that planning process. So this is, you know, yes, it's single purpose, but we're creating objectives for achieving that single purpose that recognize opportunities beyond just flood risk management. And then next slide, please. So this is just an example of quantifying environmental quality benefits from the Upper Guadalupe River project. In the core, we're very obsessed with having models for everything and showing that they're rigorous and they've been quality control reviewed and so on and so forth. But anyhow, if we want to claim some environmental quality benefits in terms of, you know, habitat suitability, et cetera, we have to go through a process like this. But we are, in fact, doing this to tell the story better about the potential benefits of doing a, quote, comprehensive benefits plan at Upper Guadalupe. And then just next slide for some closing thoughts. These are mostly cautions. But yeah, again, just underscoring, we've been encouraged to identify the comprehensive benefits plan, but we still don't have carte blanche permission to actually get those authorized. It still has a permission process that we need to go through. And in fact, our district is the first in the country to attempt to get one of these permission slips. We're in the middle of the process right now at the good old Port of Oakland, speaking of places that Jim McGrath spent some time. And what we are recommending there in the spirit of a, quote, comprehensive plan, one that maximizes benefits across all the accounts, is one that would have electrification of the dredges as opposed to diesel being baked into the plan, even though from a federal perspective, and I understand the Bay Area air quality stuff has its own thresholds, and that's a separate conversation. But from a federal perspective, you know, how much of a project would the Corps be allowed to participate in financially? We can't get to electrified dredges under an NED type approach, but under comprehensive benefits, we can. And so that's what we have pitched up to the Assistant Secretary's office, and we're awaiting that approval now. So it's kind of a prototype. It's not, in our minds, a big ask, but it is maybe a little bit of a proof of concept that we're keeping our fingers crossed on here. And then, of course, there's the good old Office of Management and Budget. They've never been particularly supportive of anything other than NED. We've had plans get approved all the way through to, you know, authorization by Congress that are not, quote, NED. And oftentimes OMB just says, yeah, we don't want to fund that. So we do need to see a change in the mindset of OMB if we're going to have some of these more comprehensive plans go forward when they cost more than the NED plan. Of course, that's why OMB gets excited. And then just, you know, a little practical matter for us practitioners is that Congress still has on the books this idea that we should complete our feasibility studies within 3 years. So there's no extra time being granted per se to really identify these more comprehensive benefit plans. And then reiterating in the final little footnote there, when we actually are complete with rulemaking on the agency specific procedures for the new principles and guidelines, this somewhat onerous process of getting an authorized and appropriated more comprehensive benefit type plan, I think will be a much smoother one if we have those governing procedures in place. So anyhow, thank you for letting me get into a lot of core bureaucracy stuff, but I think it bodes well for the future, and I appreciate the chance to share it with y'all.
Thank you, Tom.
And I'm glad Dr. Riley had lots of pictures, because mine was very text heavy.
Great. Thanks, Tom. And we have two more speakers. So the next speaker is Rick Thomaser from Napa Flood. Rick, do you want to take it away?
Sure. Yeah, good morning. I'm the Deputy Director of Public Works for Napa County and the District Manager for the Flood Control District. And thank you for the opportunity to provide comments this morning. Our Napa County's had a long history of and a really good working relationship working with your staff to design and construct projects that both meet our engineering needs for flood protection, but also enhance the environment. So we strongly encourage, the good work that Dr. Riley has done and others on your staff. Riley showed you some pictures of the Napa project, but our experience with biotechnical engineering started with the flood control project, which has been under construction since 2000 and actually in design since the late 1990s. This is a picture of what's called the Oxbow Bypass. And this is the inlet side. So this is where the river actually overflows into the bypass. And it was built in 2015 there. The picture on the left is the inlet under construction. And then in 2019, after the vegetation got established, but that this is where the river actually overflows into the bypass. And so it's seen flows now, I'd say about five times it's actually operated since it was constructed, and it's holding up really well. This particular design is interesting. The traditional engineering design was going to be a riprap slope with a sheet pile toe, and what we actually have is a vegetated slope. So there is riprap buried under there, and there is indeed a sheet pile toe under the water, but it's always submerged. Next slide, please. This is kind of a current picture of that. So you see, we have essentially a pretty natural bank condition. So we don't the exposed rock there at the toe. It's actually help support that a edge of tules. So we have a nice, river bank situation there. Next slide. And Riley pointed out some work on Napa Creek. So this is actually biotechnical bank stabilization under construction on the left, and then after it's grown in for a few years on the right. You can see the really large root wads. These were actually redwood trees that we had to cut down as a result of the project. They were in a parking lot area. So there was a whole grove of trees that we were able to harvest and use the trunks and the root wads for the toe protection you see here, and create very nice in-stream refugia for fish, as well as protect the bank. And this is function, this particular design we've used up and down Napa Creek. And next slide. It's functioned and held up really, really well. And it looks great. You can see there it is again under construction. And then in the lower right-hand side, what it looks like today. So it's really natural looking, and it's held up well. Next slide. Speaking of work the Corps has done, so that we have a little historical picture there of Riley mentioned the Third Street Bridge, which we did replace. This is actually some photos and images looking downstream from that Third Street Bridge. And so the upper left-hand picture is what the Napa River looked like in the late 1800s. And the Corps has been working on the river since that time frame. They used to dredge in that area because that's the head of navigation for the river. And the spoils would be placed just immediately adjacent on the banks of the river, wherever they, you know, could offload them. And as a result, the second on the right-hand side, the picture on the upper right-hand side is a picture during our flood project construction where the riverbank was being set back. So you see the beacon or the navigation aid in the picture. That was that placed by the Coast Guard in preparation for the flood project, and it's at the toe of the original bank. But all of that material that we subsequently excavated to create the condition in the lower left, which is the today's condition, we created a marsh plain terrace, that it was pretty much all dredge material that had been placed over the years. And so we've you know, excavated that away and now have again a more natural river bank situation. Next slide. This again is those looking towards the Third Street Bridge. You see it in the background there. Again, the upper left is the project under construction, and then the lower right is what the Marsh Plain Terrace looks like today. So it's a really great habitat situation. It's inundated, you know, daily with the tides. Has a nice that toe. Go to the next slide, actually. It's going to be a few slides down, but I'll talk about that toe in a minute, the bank toe. Here's some examples of concrete retaining walls for creeks, all sorts of great urban design from the 1970s, trying to stabilize banks. And then that all was removed. And the picture on the bottom is the current creek setting in that location. Next slide. Here's the picture I wanted to show you. So this is the it's kind of a typical riprap slope after many years of just, you know, the riprap being in place, and the same slope as it is today. You know, the Corps really felt it was important to have rock at this location because Soskal Avenue is in the background on the top of bank in this area. And it's, you know, it's a really large street. It would be very inconvenient for the bank to erode to that street. So having this armored protection is important, but we were able to put that below the surface and have a planted surface. So we've done that quite a bit. Next slide. So turning my attention a little bit, or your attention, to the our work in the upper Napa River, the flood project was sort of where we got our start working with your staff on biotechnical solutions. And we've greatly expanded that to restoration projects in the upper Napa River. We actually just this year completed our 13th consecutive year of construction on the Napa River restoration between Rutherford and Oakville. It's about 15 miles. This is a nice shot of a restored channel with a secondary channel on the right. The little inset picture is actually a pre-project picture. It's kind of hard to see, but we've done a lot of great work with compliments again to your staff helping lead the regulatory design and review team in terms of permitting for these projects. It's been really great to work with them. And we hope to do many more projects with you. Next slide. This is just another image of a sort of setback bank instead of the typical eroded vertical banks that you see. We've had room, and we've been fortunate that landowners in this location have been willing to set back their agriculture in a way that allows us to you know, widen these river cross sections. This is actually just, again, right after construction at the beginning of planting. And then the next slide, I think it's my final slide, just a view of plant revegetation planting in progress on one of our projects. Those are all my slides. Bottom line, I guess I would say, you know, we, when they're appropriately designed and located appropriately, biotechnical solutions have been working great for us, and it just as well as more traditional engineered solutions. They often these solutions probably cost less than the more armored solutions, particularly when you take into account the less of a need to mitigate for the project, because they become self-mitigating. And circulars like Dr. Riley's are really helpful for project designers. So they kind of know what staff is looking for and the permitting staff. So it is helpful to have documents like this out there to help guide project design. And that's it for me.
Well, Rick, thanks so much. And thank you as well for reminding me, of course, of your position with the county in addition to the flood control district. So thanks to Tom Kendall for giving us some welcome news about the Corps' new approach on project design. Rick, for providing some examples of how the Bay Area has been a leader in doing that up on the Napa River and Napa Creek. And last but not least, we have John Bourgeois from Valley Water, who I think is going to reflect Valley Water, of course, like Napa, is a key local project sponsor. He's going to reflect on something a little bit closer to the Bay. So, John, let me hand it off to you.
Yeah, thank you, Keith. And good morning, everyone. It's good to see everyone. Very happy to have been invited to address the board. My name is John Bourgeois. I am the Deputy Operating Officer for Watershed Stewardship and Planning at Valley Water, and really appreciate being invited here today. I am going to shift gears a little bit in my presentation. So I do want to say that Valley Water has not necessarily reviewed Dr. Riley's circular, and I'm not really commenting on its content. However, the circular does start to address the issue of core project authorization process and the opportunities and constraints that authorization can pose, along with suggestions for improvement on how to navigate the process. And that is something we'd like to comment on. Valley Water has a long and fruitful history of partnering with the Corps of Engineers, and we greatly value this partnership. It's a big part of what we do. In fact, yesterday, Corps leadership actually presented to our board on over a half dozen projects that we're working on together. And Tom mentioned one of those in his presentation on the Upper Guadalupe project. Looking ahead, we're just completed kind of a comprehensive One Water framework planning framework for our projects, and there are definitely more multi-benefit projects on the horizon. And I think I'm going to be talking about a Baylands project today, but I think it's fairly safe to say that a lot of the low-hanging fruit is gone. These large multi-benefit projects are going to get more challenging to design, to fund, to permit, and to build. And so I'm really encouraged by Tom's comments and presentation. I think any additional flexibility in the core project authorization project would be welcome as a local project sponsor. Anything that can allow us to have some creativity to complete these complex projects and be able to incorporate in some ecosystem components is really welcome. And so I'd like to quickly describe for you the South San Francisco Bay Shoreline Project. This is a large tidal flood protection project and ecosystem restoration effort. It also includes the State Coastal Conservancy as another of the non-federal sponsors. So as you can see in this first map here, the way the Corps does this is they divide the shoreline into what's called economic impact areas, or EIAs, for which a benefit cost ratio is are developed. And this gets to that NED aspect that, Tom mentioned. The first phase of this project was focused in the Alviso area, kind of on the far right side of this image here. And it's about 4 miles of coastal levee That levy facilitates and allows up to about 2,900 acres of tidal marsh restoration. So there's a big ecosystem lift component with this, and project construction actually began in 2021. However, as a part of that design, we wanted to include these broad upland transition zones against the levee. And despite the fact that these adjacent upland features are called for in things like the Balin Goals Report and the Tidal Marsh Recovery Plan, they're basically essential parts of what we call a complete marsh. At the time, the core ecological model was not able to discern the benefit from these features. And therefore it didn't really register in the BCRs and therefore did not get included in the NED. So the local sponsors were fully responsible for the cost of these. You can imagine trucking in a lot of dirt to make these transition zones have a high cost. And so if you're not able to register the benefit, it really doesn't contribute toward the NED. And so we had to put that in what is called a locally preferred plan. And the local sponsors had to bear all the cost of those components. There was no cost sharing on those components. So a question for Tom, maybe in the Q&A, is I'm curious how this comprehensive benefits plan possibly relates to an LPP. Wes, could you go to the next slide? We're working on the next phase now of Shoreline. So we're in phase two planning right now, and this is in the Palo Alto area. So this is the areas outlined in yellow, kind of on the left side of the screen here. I'm happy to report in phase two, the Corps has a new model that's been approved that actually does a much better job of capturing the benefits of these upland transition areas. So that's a really positive step that we're happy about. And the project right now is in the process of developing our tentatively selected plan. Next slide. And so this is just kind of some of the preliminary alternatives that are being looked at, but you can kind of see in yellow, it might be a little hard to discern. One of the alternatives attempts to balance the need. So this is where it says reach one, this whole area that looks like wetlands. This is actually the Palo Alto flood basin. And so this is a flood detention system for three different creeks that run through Palo Alto. And so this alternative is looking to attempt to balance the needs for fluvial flood storage while also opening up new areas of this Palo Alto flood basin to make them new tidal areas, to actually put them on the bay side of the levee, so we'll have new tidal areas. So one of the issues we also face is that since tidal restoration of these areas, whether it's a salt pond or whether it's a flood detention basin, because they're already waters of the state or waters of the U.S., these restoration efforts are simply result in a conversion of type of waters and therefore sometimes require additional mitigation. So despite the fact that this would be hundreds of acres of new tidal wetlands, we may have to mitigate for that. So these are the sorts of things that are challenging when we're trying to think creatively and build in kind of large ecosystem components to these projects. This has, I think, the unintended consequence of sometimes pushing projects into mimicking the existing landscape. You know, the levee locations that were put in place decades ago were put there for very different reasons. But you know, sometimes it's easier to put a new levee where the old levee goes, and so that kind of stifles creative thinking and our ability to maybe come up with a creative outcome. So, in conclusion, I just, you know, we're working through all these issues. We're confident we're going to have some good projects, and I'm very happy that phase one is actually under construction. But any additional flexibility would be welcome to allow local project sponsors the ability to creatively complete these projects, both from the flood and ecosystem component, and actually to incentivize these ecosystem components of the projects. In particular, I think there are policy issues like beneficial fill for habitats, type conversion, and even I think I want to mention long-term O&M of some of these components. Seeing some creativity and flexibility around this process would really help seeing some of these projects come to fruition from the local sponsor standpoint. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, John. Thank you, Keith. I'm gonna kind of try to grab this back to the board. We have a hard stop at 12 o'clock because we have a 12:30 closed session, and I want to give everybody a chance to stretch their legs and grab something to eat. So I want to this has been fascinating. It's very interesting to me, but I want to make sure that we have just vital questions or quick comments, but I'm going to stop us at 12, no matter what. So with that, I'm going to look for raised hands on the board. Andy.
Thanks, Jim. Thank you to all the speakers. I'm still digesting lots of information that came my way here, but I am really, really impressed, if I understand correctly. And I think maybe I would love if maybe in the next executive officer's report, we could just get a set of findings that, I mean, there was so much here, it's hard for me to isolate them all, but what in essence I hear, if I understand correctly, Dr. Riley, is that what used to be considered revolutionary and experimental has now been verified to be high performance and actually multi-benefit producing. So when we integrate across all the benefits from these stream restoration approaches, we are getting, not only are we getting the flood protection we always wanted, but we're getting all sorts of other things too. And we have the capacity now through your circular and through other efforts to really demonstrate to people that what might have traditionally been sort of seen as a risky approach is actually something that is really becomes standard engineering. And it appears from the presentation that we had in Napa, from Napa, that this in fact is rolling along, and it's rolling along so much that we're even getting the Corps of Engineers to slowly turn the oil tanker here. And to think about integrating across all the benefits we're getting from these projects. So I guess I would like to hear from Riley or any of the speakers, did I get that right? And I would be, if someone maybe just could direct me to a short summary, because again, I feel like once again, Region 2 is demonstrating how we use collaborative science to bring what seems experimental over the years into regular practice.
Riley, I think that's to you if you had some thoughts.
Sure. This second circular that provides guidance to communities who are addressing flood control projects has several chapters that set out the government manuals that have been produced since the late 90s that have the engineering guidance, the new engineering guidance. So yes, this has occurred. Engineers are using that engineering guidance. And the Water Board, the staff that deals with Section 404-401 permit applications, we provide tables from the Army Corps documents, design documents, from the Natural Resources Conservation Service design documents, and provide those to our applicants so that they can quantify, for example, the benefits of soil bioengineering and compare it to the engineering performance of riprap. So if soil bioengineering can withstand the same shear stresses and pounds per square foot as, you know, 6-inch riprap, then we want to know why they're not using the soil bioengineering. Indeed, we are using the federal guidance to help guide how we handle our permit applicants.
And are we finding that are you finding that when presented with this information, that our permit applicants are sort of expanding the frame in which they think about what might be successful and productive project for their community. So that we are seeing what we just saw with, you know, with the Napa is really becoming more of the standard than it used to be 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah, the answer on that is yes. And thank you to Napa County for being such a model that we can point to. The new paradigm takes a while to sink in, you know, to local practice. Some regions of the Bay have embraced this and really integrated that paradigm into what they do. Others have been slower to do this. So we do get a range of, what would I say, culture and behavior. But is it moving toward this restoration paradigm? Very much so.
Well, no matter how good an idea you might have, it always takes a while to alter existing culture. My hat is off to you, madam. I mean, you have been, this is a personal achievement, I believe, of yours that I greatly respect. And also though of our organization. And I think that it's again, whenever I can, I love to frame it as, you know, we are really an evidence-driven group and we are able to demonstrate now using, I love that, just look at the engineering guidance. That's just spectacular achievement in my opinion. And it's been a tremendous amount of work over years and years. And now that we can show these before and after photographs, I just think it's really extraordinary and it bodes incredibly well for the kind of presentation this board will hear in 20 years from subsequent staff looking at the regional transformation in our waterways. And in my opinion, we will see not only the adequate flood protection, but this incredible expansion and other beneficial uses that have been preserved, enhanced, and expanded because of this approach to how we deal with flood protection in our creeks. So thank you so much for this presentation and congratulations to everybody involved. I think this is quite an achievement.
Thank you, Board Member Gunther. Any other questions or comments? I'm going to throw in my 2 cents or probably a little more than a nickel. I think you can all tell why Riley was one of the first people on my list to talk to after I was appointed. I've lived with this for decades. In 1983, I studied river engineering at Cal under Dr. Shen, who had come from Colorado State University to Cal because he understood sediment movement. And that was the great shortcoming. So I did that controversial thing that only a graduate student in his 30s would do. I invited Phil Williams to come and talk to the class about San Lorenzo Creek and the problems with why we needed much better models. So this stuff is all very real. I've attended more than one of the watershed council meetings. And in fact, I go back on this in the Bay Area to 1973, when my wife's best friend was flooded out of her house because of back flooding on Wildcat Creek. So what we see now in the comparison in terms of designing with nature and with realistic sediment models, between the San Lorenzo Creek example and Napa are just dramatic. And you know, there's a difference in the watershed too, but and as Andy noted, Riley has been at the forefront of much of this. It really matters. The culverts that we put in throughout Berkeley, I've had a hand in dealing with those as we've improved parks. Almost all of them are at some stage of failure. And we end up with buried ticking time bombs. So doing it in this manner with solid science and solid engineering is fabulous. And I thank you all. If there are no other comments, Tom, can you give us about 2 minutes on the next meeting?
I tell you what, Jim, could I offer just a brief closing remark if you don't mind?
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Jim McGrath, excuse me. I wanted to thank our three speakers, again, Rick, Tom Kendall, and John Bushwell, and also to reflect, you and Dr. Gunther have noted the substantial increases in sort of technical capacity and knowledge. I also really appreciate what Tom Kendall and John Bushwell reflected on, which is that with the best will and understanding in the world, unless we can pay for it, we're going to be challenged to get these revised designs implemented. And so what we heard from Tom is this sort of hopefully new flexibility from the core. And then what we heard from John Bushwell is, who of course previously led the South Bay Salt Pond Restoration Project, is sort of the technical understanding that tells us why we can do that and the willingness of the local sponsor, in this case, Valley Water, to step up for these revised projects. So I just wanted to reflect on that funding aspect as well.
Thank you.
Right.
Thanks for bringing this to us. Tom?
Yeah, so this is the end of the regular board meeting. There's no need for a closed session associated with any pending legal actions. But you should state for the record that you're going to be adjourning this meeting and reconvening in closed session where you're on personnel matters, and that you don't intend to come back to this meeting after that. Or perhaps you could ask legal counsel to make sure I confirm that I've advised you correctly.
Yes, so we're going into closed session the board is going to close session for item 8 on the agenda. It's personnel, and you will adjourn the meeting after you conduct the closed session. And that closed session will be on a different Zoom platform. So this meeting Correct. Will effectively be shut down.
So Tom, I was just looking for a little guidance to the board about what we can expect in the April board meeting.
Oh, excuse me. I misinterpreted what you said.
That's okay.
What you can expect is the key item, the premier item, will be the proposed draft climate change related basin plan amendment. So we're on the cusp of public noticing that proposed basin plan amendment. And the April meeting will be what I call the testimony hearing. The board won't be asked to take an action. We'll just be able to hear testimony, ask questions, and then we would come back to the board probably two meetings later with an agenda item to actually act on. There will be some other regulatory actions that we expect to happen in April are most likely going to be on the consent calendar. So it will be the primary item will be the basin plan amendment.
All right. Any questions from the rest of the board? Or if not, I'd like a motion to adjourn, noting that we are going to reconvene at 12:30 in a closed session, but will not be reporting back, and that will not be an open session. So, motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
So ordered. We are adjourned. We'll see you at 12:30.